Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month by Bell Racing Helmets USA. This episode, we have my friend, the Uncle Bobby, Bobby Unser, three-time Indy 500 winner, probably the silliest, most beloved, most cantankerous Indy 500 winner, maybe Indy 500 driver of all time. We chose to focus on the 50th anniversary of Uncle Bobby's first win at Indianapolis, 1968, and not just the win itself, but a particular angle. We actually reached back to 1966 to start the conversation, and that's about turbochargers. Uncle Bobby was one of three drivers to help bring natural aspiration to its eventual demise. It would certainly come back here in the Indy Racing League era, but in 1966, Uncle Bobby was one of three drivers to turn up at the Speedway in a car powered by a turbocharged Offenhauser engine. And from the things they learned in 66, by 1968, he was able to become the first winner using a turbocharged engine. And from 68 through 1996, there's an unbroken string of turbo engines leading every winner home to victory lane at the Speedway. Fun talking with Uncle Bobby as always. And his honest assessments about the Huffaker chassis built by my nearby friend in Northern California, Joe Huffaker. That might not be one where if you're a Huffaker fan, you might want to fast forward through that part because Uncle Bobby is his honest, honest self. Definitely not afraid to mention the chassis shortcomings, but also gave praise to what they found with the engine back then, which would lead to such big, big things for him in 1968. As I mentioned at the outset, this May, the Marshall Pruitt Podcast is being supported by Bell. Proven since 1956, Bell helmets have been the choice of champions when it comes to state-of-the-art head protection. Designed for professionals and amateur drivers alike, Bell is synonymous with safety, innovation, performance, and engineering excellence. You can learn more about Bell helmets by visiting bellracing.com. And knowing Uncle Bobby, right, there's no such thing as a linear conversation with our New Mexican friend. We get into a variety of stuff that wanders and loops back. And then we also get into some of the 1970s and turbocharging and his relationship with Dan Gurney. And, I mean, all I can say is, as usual, buckle in. You're probably going to laugh a few times. I know I was laughing throughout it, and I hope that you enjoy this little conversation with Uncle Bobby, somewhat heavily on a technical angle. This is certainly a tribute to turbocharging and what it has become of the Speedway, but we're definitely talking with one of its pioneers and someone who didn't just use turbo engines as a driver in a passive sense. Uncle Bobby, being one of the sport's great tinkerers, certainly had his nose down trying to steer things in whatever direction he thought should happen in the dyno room. All right, you know you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes, on Podbean, on our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page. We're also posting them on YouTube now, and I hope that sometime soon here we will have Spotify, Google as well. They are certainly available on Google Music. So, all right. I mean, we're just trying to make this available to you wherever you might want to get it. But let's get to Uncle Bobby, and more time than I expected with my friend. But I'm hoping that, A, you not only enjoy the tales, but he's going to be here, I think, tomorrow in the media center, and we're going to try and capture some more about Lord knows what. All right, off we go with Uncle Bobby. Obviously, in 68, 50 years ago, you broke a barrier with the first turbocharged car to get to victory lane, and I thought it might be fun, knowing that how much you and I enjoy talking about the technical side of things, to walk down that part of memory lane, but maybe starting 2 years before in 66, because not only did you get to victory lane first with a turbo engine, but it was you and Herc and I believe one other driver in 66 who were the first ever to show up with turbos. I'm wondering.
Rutherford was one of them. He and I think, Marshall, were the first two.
Yeah.
And What would Herc have been driving that had a turbo on it?
It was a Gerhardt that he had. And speaking of Bay Area, yeah, he was in a Gerhardt. And speaking of Bay Area, you were in one of Huffaker's cars, I believe. As Joe Senior told me a couple years ago, he reached out to the Meyer, Louis Meyer, and the Drake folks, and said, "Hey, we'd like to turbocharge one of these," and they basically sold them what they needed and kind of wandered down that path. So I know the 66 car wasn't, all the things you dreamt of, but I just thought maybe we could start there talking about here you are again with something that is unique at the Speedway and you're having to trying to develop back there in 66.
That's what we were doing. Those things were so new. Nobody knew anything about them. Herbie Porter always told everybody he was a genius on them, but shit, his didn't run worth a hoot, you know? In other words, his didn't pull a lot of power. We used his engines all the time in tire testing. So when he switched off of the normally aspirated, which Herbie did a good job, but he just couldn't make power, you know? I used to just do anything to not run his engines.
Really?
Because I did probably there was times when I probably did 75% of all Goodyear's tire testing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd do it for every week, you know, and Rutherford wasn't doing that much. Floyd, of course, he's up and down. You never know what he's going to do, you know. And occasionally McCluskey, but it's mostly Bobby. And so, you know, we'd be running that new stuff, and then Goodyear would come out with some rules that within themselves that we couldn't do any more experimenting. They'd say, when we do tire testing, we got to test some tires for them instead of just car for ourselves.
Sure.
Which I was accused of that all the time, often, you know, and which was the truth, you know. To hell with a Goodyear, let's get the goddamn race car where we'll win a race. That was the idea, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, the tires, I mean, you gotta know that often that I cheated a little bit on the tires. In other words, I was smart enough to know what a D number was on the tire. I was smart enough, if I found a good set of tires, to remember the D number. And I was smart enough to have some good friends in development of Goodyear. So I somehow or another end up with some good tires. Sometimes the other guys wouldn't, you know.
And that's the part that I find interesting. So you're doing tire testing. You are trying to help usher in developing of a new type of engine. I mean, if we go back in time, obviously there was a turbo diesel or two in the race, so it's not as if a turbocharged engine had never been at the Speedway, but I'm more referring to the common naturally aspirated engines that are then turbocharged, like the Offie. What do you recall, Bobby, from this 1966 Huffaker chassis and this turbocharged engine?
Number one, Marshall, remember one thing. Let me just interrupt you just a second on that. That was the worst Huffaker chassis that he ever built, I'm sure. I don't care if he built a goddamn wagon back in the 1600s. That would have been the worst one that he ever built. Car was no good. He made big mistakes on that car. And the only thing that saved that car was the turbocharged engine. That's the only way I qualified for the race. You know when that accident happened on the front straightaway?
Yeah.
The reason I missed that friggin' accident, the car was so slow that by the time I got there, it was all over, you know?
Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, it was a terrible, terrible race car. And then, you know, that year, now, if my memory is wrong, you tell me, but I think that was the year they accredited Hill from England.
Yep.
Graham Hill of winning the race, right?
Yep, they sure did.
Okay, but the thing is, you look at that thing halfway through that race, without me being accurate now, I'm ahead of Graham Hill. And my car's going so freaking slow, you had to drive a stake alongside of it to see if it moved. In other words, it was a shit box.
Yeah, yeah.
And the worst that Huffaek ever made, but I had that turbo offy engine in it, see?
And what about the chassis wasn't working? I mean, obviously, a turbo motor is going to help you down the straight, of course, but then they have those right. four fangled corners you got to get through.
Yeah.
Was it just a diabolical oversteer, understeer, or what?
There was so much wrong with that thing, I couldn't even begin to remember how bad it was. It was a real bad car. You know, I tried that car in testing. I tried it different places. Just was no good. Number one, the tub was like a rubber band. You know, we didn't know much about tub flexing in those days.
Yeah.
But we were all starting to talk about it. And that means Gurney and that means Huffaker, who was a very good builder. And it meant all of that stuff. All of those guys. There were some smart guys in those days. But nobody knew anything about a tub flexing. In other words, you know, the old Huffakers were tubular. And, you know, the ones that had the... the goddamn, I was going to call it boots, but the rubber deals on them.
The MG liquid suspension cars.
MG liquid suspension. Goddamn it, I couldn't remember that. And I work on them here in Albuquerque, you know? That was what our business was.
Yeah.
But at any rate, those things were fast, and they handled good. Problem is, they had just a plain old 255 engine in it, off the engine. And those things got outdated pretty quick. And so now I get with a new chassis, because we figured if he built a good one, like the MG liquid car, then the next one's going to really be good. So I asked Van Loo to buy me one, and he did. Or Goodyear did, whichever one paid for it, I don't know. But nonetheless, somebody bought me one, and it was no good.
Mm.
And we tried and tried and tried to make it go fast, but it just wouldn't. And besides that, it's going to bite me if I'd have just left it alone
sure.
a little bit, you know, because it just wasn't made to go fast. And I think that I derived what all of that whole thing got over with, and we quit running the Huffakers, which sad because Joe was really a good builder.
Yes, he was.
But the car wouldn't go fast. The car wouldn't handle good. Handle good was the problem. The off-e engine, the turbo, saved it. That's how I got it into Indianapolis. But it was really as slow as I'm telling you. I mean, I physically, one time before Milliken passed away, Howard, and he was one of my mechanics.
Mm.
From Albuquerque here, you know. At any rate, the Huffaker car was so bad, that's the one that they lost off the Salt River Canyon. Went down with the station wagon and the trailer and all.
Oh, I didn't know about that story.
Didn't you? Oh, yes, yeah. We finished running down in Phoenix, and when they're coming home to Albuquerque, somehow or another, the whole rig jumped off the Salt River Canyon off a cliff.
Oh, Lord.
Norm Shoup was driving it, and of course, word had it around that the car was no good, so we're going to get rid of it, and that Van Loo had bought some insurance on it. Now, I know Van Loo didn't buy insurance knowing he was going to ruin the car, because he got mad at everybody because it happened. The insurance company accused him of doing it, you know. So it was really Howard and Shoup that did it. It wasn't even me. I got mad about it too, because I was afraid somebody could accuse me of wrecking the car that was no good.
I don't know what happened. It just kind of fell off a cliff. Really.
The station wagon, the trailer, and the race car, and but the toolbox didn't go.
isn't that amazing how physics works, Bobby? You know what I mean? I mean, that's incredible.
I got home after that. I had a junky old airplane. I got home, and somebody called me and told me that the car was not only wrecked, but off the Salt River Canyon, but then also the chute. Now, the guy that's guilty of this shit, now, he ought to be smarter than this, ran a goddamn jalopy race that night in Phoenix, same night that he supposedly had to go to the hospital and get doctored up a little bit because the station wagon jumped off Salt River Canyon. Now, that was kind of bad, you know?
Oh, that is brilliant.
I called that shoop. I'm sure I fired him. I didn't even have the right to, you know?
Oh,
I'm telling you what.
Wow.
But that was Huffaker's deal. That car was just no good, you know?
So you move, first of all, your result that year, I mean, obviously it was a very sad year, but, you know, you were credited with eighth at the finish, which is, you know, a miracle. Next year, you're in an Eagle with, you know, Ford power, and get to 68, and you're back in a turbo car. Do you recall, Bobby, what, you know, from that first experience in 66 at the Speedway with the Offey turbo, do you recall if there was much development either power wise or otherwise when you came back to a turbo Offey in 68?
Ton of development, Marshall. Number one above everything else, we got the good mechanics. Judd Phillips. Come on. That guy is so friggin' good, I couldn't even begin to tell you how. I mean, he just was a good mechanic. Little Red. I mean, the two of them, they'd do mechanical work like a band playing. I mean, they didn't have to talk to each other. I mean, they knew what to do to a race car to make it feel good, go fast, be reliable, the stuff that was really important. So look at all the guys that switched over to that turbo. Now, after we did it in 68, of course, everybody wanted one then. But that's kind of normal, isn't it? In other words, the car was obviously very fast. But in 66, the discovery happened. Because, man, when I'd light that thing up going down those two long straightaways, that son of a bitch would go like hell. And it didn't go through the short chutes good, meaning, you know, you didn't have enough room for the turbo to get to acting really good, you know?
Yeah.
And the car couldn't handle good. But, man, when you'd come off a number four, number two turn, and I mean, you knew that turbo had kicked in. Because, I mean, if there's somebody in front of them, you're just going to pass them. Doesn't make any difference who they are. And there's got to be some way, if they think that Graham Hill actually won the race, there's got to be some way that I passed that son of a bitch and went on by him in a junky car, you know?
Yeah.
It's all the engine. So when we went back in 68, I mean, everybody had heard about everything. Herbie Porter now it becomes the guy that knows the most in the entire world about turbocharging, supposedly, you know. But you get guys like Judd Phillips involved and Little Red. Man, all of a sudden, I mean, we actually dynoed that winter. The Offey.
Yeah.
I mean, Fizzy, it's the first time Judd wouldn't dyno the Offeys. He wouldn't dyno anything. He knew how to build them. He built them himself in that little dinky-ass garage. Same thing in California. Little dinky-ass place. But he knew how to make like a 255 Offey run. He knew how to make all those engines that they've been running run. But the turbo Offey is new. And so he calls me on the phone here in Albuquerque one day. And of course, I'm tickled to death with it. I got a free car out of Goodyear, or maybe two, I don't know, one car, I think, and got some engines just for the asking.
Yeah.
And Judd and I had talked it over on what we should have, you know. And I was starting to become Goodyear's hot shot driver. In other words, I'd worked my way into a really good position with Goodyear. Good money and nice to me, give me anything I wanted, that type of deal. And so Judd and I get to talking. He starts talking to Porter. He learns everything he can learn. Then he calls me on the phone one day and he says, "We're going to dyno this thing." He says, "You want to come out?" And I says, "Nah, I don't need to do that. I'm a little short of money in those days anyway, you know." And I says, "No, go ahead and do it." So he dynoed that thing. And listen to this, Father. He put, I could be wrong here, but I think I'm right. But 5% nitro in it. So you know now that we think we've got something, right? You can just tell by the fact that I said we put a little bit of nitro in it, you know? It was either 5 or 8%. And I'll tell you what, it made a friggin' King Kong out of that thing. Judd calls me after he runs it on the dyno. And he says, "Man, we got some power now."
Wow.
And I says, "You gotta be shitting me." I says, "From what? What'd you change?" He says, "They just put the nitro in it. Put whatever, 5 or 8%. It's not very much. I'd be used to running at Pike's Peak 25-30%, you know?
Wow.
Wake it up good, you know? But it did it in Indy. It did it on the dyno. So now I can't wait to get back there. So now it's our secret. It's our big, big, big secret. He did it down at the Champion Spark Plugs testing facility out in the LA area, Long Beach or wherever it was, you know. And I mean, the Champion guys, I mean, they were totally Bobby Unser people. In other words, I don't care what Bobby wanted. I got it from Champion. Yeah, it was Art Laimi, Dick Jones, Bobby Strowman, guys like that.
Wow. See?
And the big thing about Champion is the head guy of all the Champion company, he was my buddy.
Mm.
Man, I hooked up with them when I first started running Pike's Peak. And of course, then I started winning for them. And they started running my full page ads and Life, Look, Reader's Digest, all those hot dog magazines. They started running ads in there of Bobby Unser running Champions at Pike's Peak. And then I started winning every race.
But I mean, for such a bashful guy, that must have been embarrassing, of course.
Well, I know it. But, they were just like my benefactors.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like Perfect Circle Piston Rings.
Yeah.
Gene Stonecipher. I mean, he loved me like his own kid, you know, and all the Champion guys did. But they were sworn to nobody can know what we run. Nobody knows we were down there, or Judd was down there with the engine, dynoing it. Because, you know, you couldn't find a dyno everywhere in those days. You know, they were hard to find. And so they kept it all a secret. So now when we got back to Indianapolis, tell me if I'm going too long.
Oh, not at all. Hey, good Lord.
Sure? Okay. So at any rate, sometimes I get too wound up and get going too long, you know.
You know, that's not a problem. Not a problem.
So at any rate, now we go back to Indianapolis, and we got a good handling car. I know that. And I know we got a good running engine. And Judd built it. I mean, it wasn't built a Champion. Judd built the thing. But it'd go like hell. And then all of a sudden one day, the turbines show up and they're starting to make it a little bit squeegee on me, you know? In other words, they're going kind of fast. And Judd says, "Well," he says, "you want to zap them?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "Well," he says, "are you ready to try the nitro?" And I says, "Oh, yeah, give me that goddamn nitro. Give it to me now, in the middle of the day." Man, no way in the world would you do that successfully. too hot. And so he goes back to the back, takes the car back, and puts the nitro to it. We come back out, and there became the first 170-mile-an-hour lap in history at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Wow.
And that just shook up the turbines. Like I told Judd, maybe we shouldn't have done it, you know, because Granatelli starts getting hungry because he thinks he's got everybody sacked, in which he really should have, you know. And but now we're not doing too bad. I mean, they couldn't do 170. They had to go. They had to go run the. I was going to say diesel fuel, but airplane fuel, and they had to put a lot of wick to it. You know, turn the boost up,
sure,
like we did on the turbochargers. See, and then yeah, they outqualified me. There's no doubt about that. You know, but if we'd have really had balls, we'd have stuck another 5% in that sucker. Maybe it'd have blown the engine halfway to Arkansas. I don't know. But I'll guarantee you one thing. Boy, it loved that friggin' nitro. I mean, it loved it. And so it's been the goddamn tires on the racetrack, you know?
Wow.
And so at any rate, we qualified third quick. And then, like I explained to Robin a little while ago, he says, well, where did you find the speed come race day? I says, that was the secret to the whole thing. I said, number one, I found a really big, I didn't tell Jeff this one or Robin this, but I found a really, really big secret for the chassis. I could almost go wide open around the place.
Really?
In other words, it was just amazing. I found a handling deal that was so big, and I kept it so secret. There's only two other human beings on this earth that knew it, and that was Judd and Little Red. Even our cleanup guy didn't know what I was doing. I mean, nobody knew. And I could do it every lap and do it so easy. And then hike the left front. You know how those guys, you got to remember this. Remember how those guys down in turn one be on the inside of the, I call it the irrigation ditch down there. And they'd stand there on the other side of the fence and watch the cars go through one and tell everybody how they're handling and blah, 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 you know. Well, they'd come down to my garage. Same group of guys, and they'd say, man, they'd tell John, and they'd tell me, and they'd say, well, if that Bobby ever gets that thing handling, he's going to fly, because now I'm running 170 or a little bit better, you know?
Sure.
And then what did they say that was wrong? The left front tire's coming off the pavement and stays off all the way till about the middle of the short chute. The left front tire off the ground like a midget, like a sprint car. And so these guys had come down, man, now they really want to help me because I'm for the American, you know, I'm running an offie and blah, blah, blah. Well, shit, that was my secret. They just didn't know how I got there, you know?
Well, I mean, was that dialing in cross weight? I mean, what were you doing there to be able to you know, I guess three-wheel it through but make so much speed?
You're going to be the only guy that I can remember that I've ever told this to. Maybe I've told it to somebody else, I don't remember. But what I did is one day I'm sitting out on the line. Now, I've already run fast. And I just don't, it's not feeling good, not as good as it should. And so I'm just sitting in the car, hotter than a son of a bitch out there, and I'm just kind of staring. You know how a driver sometimes just sits in the car and he just stares into space?
Gets lost in thought, yep.
That's what I'm doing. And pretty soon I sit there, because I'm the guy that calls all the handling stuff. That's my job. And Little Red does all the adjustments. If I'm going to make something on the racetrack, which I do often, And he's the one that does it for me. You know, I'll sit in the car or maybe get out and help him. But this day I'm sitting in the car, and this actually happened. And I told Little Red, because we had anti-roll bars that ran across the whole front end and hooked up to the spindles. You know, not like the new ones of today, you know. And so that's all anybody had in those days. And so I told Little Red, I says, crank that right front sway bar out. In other words, it's got left and right-hand threads on the top and bottom, right? So I says, crank it out three turns. So he looks at me like I've just lost my head. You know, I mean, I am so touchy on that back in the shop because I do all the setups.
Sure.
That's Bobby's job, see? And so I'm just going to try something. I mean, this is stupid. I preach against doing stupid things like this. But I go out and that freaking thing, in fact, I was wrong a little while ago. I got my 170s from.
Wow.
And that's when the guys are coming over to the shop saying, man, if Bobby just gets that left front down on the ground, God help the rest of them.
So is this, sounds like you're preloading the front anti-roll bar?
When I preload that right front, that left front, it come right up off the ground.
Wow.
And I wouldn't see it. I can't tell you. Damn sure ain't got time to look at that, you know. I could see the top of it, but that's all, see. And I, you know, get the sign. Geez, I'm flying. And all of a sudden it took out that jittery problem that I had. And I told you it wasn't feeling all that good to me.
Yeah.
I was going fast, but it wasn't feeling that good. Well, it cured everything. And I could just run that some of it so hard you wouldn't believe it. And never make a mistake, never get offline. If I wanted to go a little high, I could go there and stay. If I wanted to make a bigger arc, whatever I wanted to do, all of a sudden, I can do it.
Wow.
And I can do it every lap. And I have fast speeds all the time. Take the nitro out, still go fast. Do whatever I wanted to do that the car would go fast. And remember, Marshall, we still ran treaded tires in those days.
I know.
You know? So that was really acting good for me. See, we don't know that the ball tires are going to be the answer, but I'm the tire tester. I'm the guy that does that shit. I mean, Floyd does some, John Cock does some, Rutherford does some, but not like Uncle Bobby. He does it all the time. Every friggin' week I'm testing, you know? And so that was our big, big, big chassis secret. And to the day, unfortunately, that he passed away, I never told Dan. Never told Wayne. Larry knew it, naturally. And Butch and Dean knew it, my three guys, but never Dan. You know, and later on when I drove for him with the Nice Eagles, you know.
Yeah.
I never told him then. I just kept it a secret, and I kept it from everybody. Because who knows? Someday I might have had the same problem and need the same fix. And I was the only one that really was on top of that type of a thing, you know?
Well,
I mean, everybody was taught, because everybody knew that I went fast. Everybody knew that I was a real stickler on the chassis setups. Everybody knew all that stuff. So all them guys from turn one come down there and they're going to fix it for me and tell me, just get that left front now to stay on the ground. Boy, you'll really have them sacked. Just the opposite, see?
Oh, I love it.
And then that turbocharger thing, we had, you know that I don't even know what boost I ran? And as far as I can remember, and I remember pretty good a lot of that old stuff, I don't remember how much I ran. I know we had a boost gauge in there, but you know, later on I used to work and set all my boost gauges myself. I have the machine right over here in my shop that I designed and built. Me and Milliken built it, and to check the pressure gauges to see if they're totally accurate and right. I mean, we designed, built our own right here.
Wow.
And did them better than my friggin' airplane had, you know?
Yeah,
and we just learned all of that stuff because Judd and Little Red would do it. And they believed in me. In other words, if I told them to turn that son of a bitch upside down and just put some wheels on the top, they'd have tried to do it, you know?
I love it. I absolutely love it.
They just really, you know, our team had hooked up before that. And by a team hooking up, I mean they loved me to death. I always went fast, and I didn't crash unless something went wrong, you know? And they loved it. And we didn't have but what I had. I had two guys. That's all I had.
Hmm.
Had John Little Red and a cleanup guy. And that's it. And I got him off the fence.
Well, yeah, fortunately,
remember his name half the time.
Well, fortunately, you chose him instead of Miller, so that was a good call there. You know, Bobby, I guess the last thing that comes to mind is, obviously, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of your first 500 win this year, and I know how proud you are of that, but I also know that you're proud to have been the first to drive a turbocharged IndyCar into victory lane. You know, someone who's been so heavily linked to technology and speed and progression, where does that rate among the the points of pride on this 50th anniversary, what you did on the turbo side?
You know, Marshall, I got to tell you the truth. I got a phone call one day recently, can't be over a month or two ago, and it's Doug on the phone. And I mean, he never calls me. I'm always calling him, bumming something from him, right?
Doug Bowles, IMS president, yeah.
Doug Bowles, yeah. And so Doug calls me on the phone, and I mean, this doesn't happen. It's hard to get him on the phone. You know, you're better off to email him something. And so he calls me on the phone, and he says, I need you in the parade. And I said, man, I don't do them friggin' parades. Doug, everybody knows I quit doing those things years ago. And I says, you know, I don't like them. Everybody knew that, you know. And so he says, well, can I get you to do that? And I says, if you really want me to do it, I'll do it. But I says, you got to really want me to do it, Doug. And I'm not looking for money, you know. And he says, do you realize this is the only time that's going to be this way? And I says, what are you talking about? Those weren't the exact words, you know, but yeah, close to it. He says, do you know that this is going to be your 50th year of your first win? I said, you got to be shitting me. I says, Now I got a pen out real quick, and I'm on my desk here, same place I am right now, and I'm trying to figure out how many years it's been. I says, so, the reason you want me in that parade, because this is my 50th year. He says, that's right, didn't you know that? And I says, no, I didn't even think about that. He was the first one that told me. I says, I'll do the friggin' parade for you, don't you worry.
I love it.
That was the first time that I knew that this year was going to be my 50th. Isn't that weird?
Well, I figure...
And nobody, not even Shunk, not Miller, nobody said anything about it.
Well...
Until I kind of knew it, you know?
You've got some bad friends, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I just had no idea. And so all Doug wanted was for me to do the parade. He says, we're going to build you a special trailer, you know, whatever you call them, to go in, float. And I says, good. I says, can I take I'm bringing my two daughters back this year after Doug told me that. Everything changed for me. Because Cindy and Jerry, that's my daughter's name, they hadn't been back there since they were almost babies.
Wow.
And, you know, the quilt lady used to babysit them for me. I mean, Janetta Holder, you know, that makes the quilts.
Yep.
She used to be my babysitter. And that's who Jerry's going to live with this May when she goes back. Same one that used to babysit her. Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And Janetta didn't know it. Nobody knew it. That I knew of. You know, when Shunk doesn't know it and Miller doesn't know it, you know damn good and well there's something going on, you know.
Well,
so I'm telling those guys, I says, you know, it's my 50th. Oh yeah, they're acting like they really knew it. I says, well, how come you guys don't tell me? I don't know that it's my 50th till Doug calls. Now I gotta do the friggin' parade, you know.
See, their fault. It's their fault. Well,
yeah. I mean, I was really surprised. Where did the hell in these 50 years go? I had it took me days and probably a few weeks here to get that adjusted in my head, where 50 years went. You know, I had a lot of good years at the Speedway, and I love that, love them to death. But 50 years? Jesus, criminy, catfish, you know? That's a long time.
Well, what about the distinction of being the first to win with a turbo? I mean, since then, I mean, I'd have to look and make sure, but just about every single car since your 68 win has been turbocharged, getting into victory lane. I mean, you kicked off. It's not just a trend. This is almost half of the Indy 500's history now has been won by turbos.
No doubt about that. And we knew we were doing it. And I mean, to tell you what, and you know, when I left that thing, which is, like we say, 50 years, Marshall, just think. Then I left there and went to Dan Gurney. Now I got the real John Miller. And I mean, to tell you, man, when you step on the gas, his engines step on the gas, I mean, something's going to happen. I mean, it isn't go to sleep time anymore. So I just went another step above, but a big step. And you look in 72. Jesus Christ, I just saw some pictures here a little while back. Shunk sent me of the first lap or the start, whatever it was, of that 72 race. And I'm already more than a half a straightaway ahead of them. Long straightaway, not the short shoot. And I looked at that, and I just started laughing. Thought that goddamn John Miller, I mean, to tell you what, when you stepped on that throttle, you better know where you're going, because that thing's going to go, you know? And it was that way all the time with Miller. And nobody could ever figure out his secrets. And, of course, Dan didn't like my blowing all the engines up. That was kind of the bad part about the whole thing, you know?
Well, Drino was giving you whiplash constantly with all that power. I mean, I've never come across a driver who doesn't want to dip his foot into all the power that was available. So, I mean, 1,000-plus horsepower craziness. I mean, these are just the things that we dream of.
1,100 I used to qualify with in that car. 1,100 horsepower. Man, I'm telling you what, I'll guarantee you I had a hold of that steering wheel hard, you know? But it was just that way. And that John Miller and I, we had little secrets. If I'd give him a certain look, he would know how many screws to turn in on the boost deal. I mean, we were like a married couple. I mean, if I really wanted a record that day, I'd just have to give John a certain look. And if he didn't quite understand it, he'd just come over and say, how many? Two words.
Wow.
And I'd say six or eight or something like that. That'd mean how many boost turns he screwed in for me. And mine always had the coarse thread. So if I asked for five rounds in that thing, gee, that's enough to blow the racetrack apart, you know?
Oh, I love it.
It'd always be a new track record for me. Mm. Always a new track record, if I didn't blow it, you know? And then one time at Ontario, I'd been right at the 200, but Dan didn't want me to break it until a certain time. And he wanted it done in front of you guys. He wanted it done in front of the press. I was going to do it when we were testing out there one day at Ontario, you know?
Yep.
And I got it. In other words, I know when I got it, you know? I can really tell. So I went over to Miller and gave him the little high sign, and he doesn't say a word, but Dan, by then, had discovered John and my high signs to each other. So Dan comes over to me and he says, Bobby, and he didn't want anybody else to hear it. He says, Bobby, don't do that. And I says, I know he's got it figured out by then, you know? And I says, I got to do it. I says, I'll give it to you right now. I'll guarantee you right now I'm going to do a little bit more than 200 miles an hour now. In the middle of the day. And Dan says, please don't do it. I says, why, Dan? Why? Tell me why. I can do it right now. And he says, no, please. We got to have the press here. Who's going to know about it? We don't even let people up in the grandstand to watch. He says, there's nobody watching us. Not even Parnelli's crew is out here spying on us. And I says, well, shit, that's like telling the race driver, don't go fast. I mean, that's no good. It hurt my feelings. And then the race is right around, not too far behind that test that we were doing, see? And I go out to qualify, and I'm going to run more than 200, that's for damn sure, because I did it the next day. And the goddamn thing blows the intake manifold off. Mm. I mean, well, it has so much boost, it just blew the goddamn thing apart. And I mean, quit running, you know? And that gurney went and did everything I did to my car, did it to Jerry Grant's car. Almost caused me to quit. In other words, I was an inch away from leaving Dan after that.
Wow.
I mean, Grant doesn't do anything, and he's one of my best friends. He don't do jack shit. I mean, he doesn't run fast enough to get the dents off the tires most of the time. But he can when he has to do it. He can close a goddamned eye or two and go wide open. And he doesn't know what he's doing or how he got there, but he's a nice guy. Well, he went out and he does the fast time, whatever the hell his speed was. And it hurt my feelings so bad, I didn't know what to do. So the next day, Miller gets me settled down and Wayne. And I just couldn't even sleep that night. I was so pissed because I had in the palm of my hand long before that. And Dan ain't going to let me do it, see? And so I go out the next day and just knock the balls off of him and went way faster than Grant did. And wouldn't even basically didn't want to talk to the press. I was pissed at everybody because that was my deal, you know, not anybody else's. I could have done that a month or two before that for Dan. And he just didn't want me to do it, you know? I could have done it anyway. But I didn't do that to Dan, you know? And so there's where the 200 came from. And, of course, I got on Dan, you know, another argument, because why did you just give that away? It was mine. And I earned it. And I deserved it. And I'm the one that made this car where it'll go that fast. It won't go that fast for Grant. I mean, for nobody. If they don't do the little things that I'm doing to it, it won't do it. And I got to have John Miller, too. John Miller, he did it for Grant, though, because Gurney told him to, see?
Wow.
He ran the same friggin' boost that I was getting, see? And that just, it's cheating, you know?
Mm.
My car, I'm the one that did the testing on it, the development. I'm the one that found all that shit. I mean, I was so burned up you wouldn't believe it. And that was probably the start of Dan and I not getting along as well as we should have.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I pulled a few shitties on him too, you know.
Understood.
That was my race car, you know. One time we were going to go to Trenton, and I know that goddamn Grant's chief mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
He and I didn't get along at all, and I know because see, I can look at an Eagle in those days. I can physically walk by it, and I can look at the springs and tell you what rate they are. I can look at the chassis and tell you how much tip it's got in it, how much rake it's got in it. I can look at an Eagle and tell you everything. So at any rate, I know that they're cheating on me and that they're going in after 10 o'clock at night because that's when Wayne goes home, 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And my car is only blocked off by those great big canvases like the nurses use in hospitals,
uh-huh.
You know, to block you off so everybody can't see you. And mine's a big, heavy canvas. And so that's how we keep my car separated from Grant's. and I had a deal with Gurney that Jerry Grant or his people won't come over there and start copying my car. Because most of the time, there's scales in both places, you know. They got their own scales. I got my own scales, you know. But they're supposed to leave my car alone. And so but I know they're not, because I can look at it. So I call now. In those days, this was something Dan did. But he had invented a way to put an entire setup on a sheet of paper. In other words, if I wanted to have so much roll stiffness, which became a big deal for us,
yeah.
That means how much the anti-roll bars do, you know, the sway bars, totally that. And he had it on a piece of paper. If I tell him hypothetically that I wanted 3,000 pounds of roll stiffness, right on my desk here, I would have a sheet of paper, and I'd call Wayne on the phone, say, put in a roll bar of this size, and that's going to get, I know that's going to give me 3,000 pounds of anti-roll, you know? And then I tell him everything on the setup. I tell him what springs. I tell him what percentage I want on the front versus the back. I tell him all these numbers, all off a paper that Dan had designed. The only other people that we know of in the world that did it, and that means the Formula One guys too, was Chrysler.
Yeah.
The goddamn Chrysler company had done it and put it on a piece of paper, same way Dan did. And Dan didn't copy him. I thought he did because I ended up driving for Ray Nichols in a stock car on occasion, mm-hmm. See? And so they had the same thing that Gurney did. So I naturally assumed they did it first, see? And so Gurney has got these things. And so I sit right on my phone, call Wayne Leary out at Gurney's shop, give him the numbers. I say, here's the size of sway bar I want, here's the size of springs, here's the tip I want, here's the rake I want, here's everything I want, all off of a sheet of paper. And so Wayne puts it on my car. See? Well, you know what I did on that one? I gave him erroneous numbers.
Really?
Really? Oh, Marshall, you wouldn't believe these numbers were so bad. I mean, it's either I'm going to roll on the floor laughing or I'm going to feel sorry for Gary Grant, you know?
Yeah.
But it's all legitimate. The rules in that company are they leave my car alone. You know, when it sits back at Indianapolis in that little garage we had, leave it alone. Don't touch it. Don't go look at it. Leave it alone. And everybody agreed to it on the team. So I walk into Trenton, go back there in my airplane, I park my plane, I go down to the racetrack, walking in with my helmet bag, having a ball. I go by Grant's car and I stop and look at it. And I says, oh, shit, there it is. He did the same, or they did, the same friggin' thing that they do every time. They're copying my car, and I can look at it and see. And so then I go over to Wayne, and I hand Wayne another sheet of paper. He says, what's this? I said, that's the springs I want, the anti-roll bars, the tip, the rake, all this shit. And they can do it. Look, those guys, I got them down to where they can do it in 15, 20 minutes, you sure. know? And because they know how I think, they know what I'm going to say most of the time. And so they didn't say a word to Gurney, not a word to Grant's deal, and made sure that we parked away from him a little ways. But up in the air, my car goes, pop, 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 off comes the springs, the sway bars, everything. And in comes a new setup. Well, I set a new track record that day, set her on the pole, and won the race. But you know what Grant did? He crashed it in the warm-ups.
Oh.
Crashed the car really bad in the warm-ups. Got all four corners, you know? And old dumbass, stupid Bobby, I am still so mad about this. So mad at Gurney for allowing this to happen when that entire friggin' team of his, a lot of people, we all have understanding in there. Leave Bobby's car alone. Don't copy Bobby's stuff. And old dumbass me, I told Dan what I did. Not that day, but after we got back to California and stuff.
I'm sure he was really happy.
He got so mad at me, you wouldn't believe it. Wow. I mean, it's supposed to ever come to a real fight, you know?
Wow.
I mean, he says, you know how much those cars cost me? I says, well, and is it, you know, my car cost me a lot if I wreck it. But I didn't wreck it. I won the race. You know, and I mean, I'm throwing shit at him as fast as he's throwing it at me, you know? And I says, no, we had an agreement. I says, I thought we shook hands on this ship. I says, not in the contract, it doesn't have to be. I said, Dan, we can't do things this way.
Wow. You know,
this stuff actually happened that way, Marshall. I caught with Clarence Cagle, or through Clarence Cagle one time, I caught that friggin' George Bignotti in 1972 with a key to my garage. Now, in those days, nobody could have a key to the garages except whoever had them, you know.
Yeah, lived in the garage.
And Clarence Cagle. Clarence had a key to every garage on the place. No question about it. But I can tell, like, my car, when it goes in there, because, see, I spend all summer in Indianapolis, rent an apartment, see? So my car goes in there on the scales, and it sits there. Now, I know how it gets on the scales, so I know. Is it on the scales a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left? Is it forward on them? They're all them old shitty-ass grain scales, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have, Dan wouldn't buy those new nice scales. We just used the old grain scales. And they'd be at the same height as the hole in the concrete would be. So we just roll the race car right in on the grain scales. And I'd do my whole setup on the grain scales.
Wow.
Well, I go back there. I go to the race shop before Wayne is loading up the car for the next race. And I look at where the car's sitting in there. And I asked Wayne, I says, when'd you guys get here? And he told me, and I says, well, did you move the car in and out of the shop? What did you do? Nothing. Haven't touched it. Haven't moved it. Oh, now I know somebody's been in my race car again. Incidentally, I'm the same way with everything that I own in this world. If I go up to my house in Colorado, I can tell if anybody's been in my garage, my house, on the property. I mean, anything. I live a life like that.
Mm.
And so I know somebody's been in there. And so I get to checking around. It's that fucking George Bignotti.
Wow.
So I go right to Clarence's office, and I tell Clarence, I says, George is doing this. He says, are you sure? And I says, well, no, I can't prove it. But I says, he's got keys to other guys' garage, too. And I says, you've got to be the only one that's supposed to have a key, and not Bignotti, to other people's garages. And I says, somebody's got my key, because I know it. And so I didn't go any further with it. Well, he went to Bignotti, and I guess chewed his ass out, and got the same thing as an agreement that George did have a key.
Wow.
You know, the goddamn guy, and I never got along with Bignotti, and I never wanted to. Goddamn it. You know, it just shitty way. And obviously, I used to fool around a little bit, but never that bad, you know? I never got in and snuck in and tried to copy somebody else's car. You know, I never would do that. And hell, I had too many people because we were going fast. Especially in 72. Jeez Christ. Everybody wanted to see my car, you know?
I remember someone I worked for who was a shop owner and race car driver, very competitive. He got caught by one of our rivals. I forget which track we were at, but we didn't have big transporters back then, so the cars would just be under an awning and you'd throw the car cover over and... let's just say that the
open trailer.
Yeah, team owner came in the morning. I guess my boss thought he got in. He was doing it early enough. But long story short, team owner came in earlier than expected and was quite surprised to see a pair of legs dangling out from beneath the car. And it was my boss under there with a flashlight looking at everything he could to try and figure out why they were going faster than us. So, oh yeah, it's a time-honored tradition, but, you know, still doesn't make people very happy.
So. I was back there, and this was 81. I had to tell you about one with Penske. This one got kind of bad, you know? Because Roger and I really got along good, Marshall. I mean, really got along good. We just didn't have arguments. We had a few disagreements, right?
Yeah.
But like, he caught me putting a different type of rear end lube in the car, you know? And goddamn, my tranny guy squealed on me. Can't believe he would do that, but he did, you know. And so we had a little argument over that. Just not a bad argument, but a disagreement. You know, I just reminded him, I run the goddamn car. You know, you want me to win races? I says, I lead every race I'm in. If I don't win them, I'm sorry, but I always lead them. And I says, now, our agreement is, I'll do my own setup. I get my own garage. Even McGee can't come in my garage. Nobody can go in my garage except me. And I get a call. I'm homesick. I got summer flu bug or something. And I'm down at the Hojo's in bed all day. And pretty soon, McGee calls me and he says, you better get your ass down here right away. And I says, what do you mean? He says, you better get down here. Penske's down here. He's got your car on the bear rack. He had Clive take the springs and shocks off of it. And he's got your car all apart, and he's really pissed. I says, you got to be kidding.
Wow.
My car is on the bear rack, and everybody can see it? He says, yeah. And I says, well, all of a sudden I ain't sick. So I says, I'll be right there. So I go down there, and Roger's out in front. We had the back garages way down towards the end where the bear rack was.
Yep.
Damn near across the aisle from it. And I go down there, and Roger's just pacing up and down. I can tell he's mad, you know. And I says, what's happening, boss? How come my car's up on the bear rack? And he says, Bobby, he says, I don't go for this. He says, you got to be straight when you work for me. And he got off on one of those kicks, see?
Mm.
And I says, so he says, I had Clive take the springs off, the shocks, and everything. He says, there's not one thing that's right on your setup sheet. Not one thing that's right. I says, well, I says, that's me. That's the way I do it. I know what's in it, though. Clive knows. I mean, come on, what's the matter? And so he says, you can't do this. He said, we can't do that. Well, I says, well, I goddamn sure ain't going to do it your way. So that means I got to go in there and give Rick Mears whatever it is that I'm running. I says, we know I'm running faster than he is. And the other guy.
Bill Alsup. Bill Alsup, I think.
Bill Alsup. Bill Alsup. Okay, so at any rate, Penske and I, that night, it got a little hot and heavy standing out there, and I'm screaming right in front of everybody. And it's about 9-10 o'clock at night, you know, and I'm still about half sick, and I got to screaming at Roger, and I just quit him. I just told him, I said, well, you can take his race cars, take it up your ass. I says, I'll find me a ride tomorrow. I said, I'll bet you I'll have me a ride before noon tomorrow. Boy, I was really mad, you know, because he'd gone too far with this. And he says, no. And I started walking away. And he says, well, wait a minute, where are you going? I said, I'm going to go back to my goddamn hotel. I said, I'll get me a ride in the morning. I said, I'm really pissed. This is not the way it works with me, and this was not our agreement. And we shook hands on this.
Mm.
You remember where, Dan? I says, England. London, England. In that hotel, whatever the name of it was in. I says, I stood up from sitting on the bed. You were sitting on the bed, and we shook hands on these very items. And some of them being the very items. Well, he says, yeah, I guess, yeah, we did do that, didn't we? I said, yeah, so I'm to believe your word's no good. Now you got my car on the friggin' bear rack. You got my springs off. Now McKee knows everything I'm running. Everybody on our team knows what I'm running. Anybody else that wants a look. And he says, well, he says, I guess we did agree on that, didn't we? And I says, hey, I told you, you know, just find another driver. You're better off to do that. Everybody's got to do what you want done or what Jim McGee. And Jim was one of my best friends.
Yeah.
But that's the racing, man. This is Indianapolis. And so Roger apologized. I go back in here and Clive my other mechanic. Oh, shit, I can't remember right now. But at any rate, they said, well, are we hired or fired? I said, no, you guys are still hired. Don't worry about that. You ain't getting off that easy. Put all that shit back on that I want. And I says, no more. Nobody's going to tell you to take it off anymore. Penske's not going to tell you anymore. It's done. No more problem with that. So that's done. Roger was sorry.
Well,
so the next day, I got to finish telling you this, Marshall. The next day, he comes up to me, and I go out, and I'm still, my stomach's still jumping a little bit, and I go fast again, you know? And I come in, and Roger gets me off to the side. Now, remember, we just didn't have arguments. You know, anything I wanted to do, he let me do. And I don't care what it cost, he let me have it. Didn't make any difference. And so the next morning I go in there and he gets me off the side and he says, I need a favor. And I says, yeah, boss, what do you need? And he says, I need you to go over there and fix Alsop's car. And I says, no. I says, ain't going to do that. No, ain't going to do that. Number one, by then we had a different chief mechanic over there. It was, Oh, fucking, I like that guy.
Yeah.
He's a nice guy. Damn it, I can't remember his name now.
That's okay.
But he was a good guy. And he was the chief mechanic on that car. But I told Roger, he says, just go over there. Set it up. He says, what do you want? I'll get anything you want. I says, just get everybody out of there. Tell whatever his name was, out and his helpers out. Get everybody out. And I says, I'm going to take in my two guys, and I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to do it. But I don't want McGee there. I don't want them. I don't want anybody in there. And I says, I don't want them changing the car when I finish with it. He says, just do it, please. Just get this over with.
Mm.
I says, okay. So he went and got the guys all out. Garage is empty. Clive and Lori, and Clive and I go over there, and Lori was my chief, yeah. We go over there and sat. It only takes me about 15, 20 minutes, and I know the succession. I weigh it myself. I do everything. And those guys do the spring changes and the stuff like that, you know? And go in there, set it up. He goes out. And he goes fast enough to qualify.
Wow.
Roger says, thank you. Boy, I'm glad we got that put away. I says, yeah, me too. But I says, Rog, I says, you know, most of those guys, one guy I really don't like. And I says, he's the guy that copied me over at Gurney's all the time. And now he's hired here by Roger. I don't even know he's working here. I said, I don't like the son of a bitch, and I don't want to be around him. Roger says, you won't have to. He's going to get in the race. Well, you know what happened? He put it in the race, all right, which he'd already been out for his two times before that. He puts her in the race, all right, but they found out that they had taken, when I finished qualifying, they took my engine out, and they put it in Alsop's car. Now, I don't know why my engine was just a number. It wasn't special. You know, I was always looking for a special engine. And I always had a choice, if there was one, a first choice, you know. But that one was just a number. It's qualifying. I know how fast I can go. That's how fast I'm going to go. And that's it. There's no nitro in them days or anything, you know. And so Alsop makes it in. But they throw him out and let him back in some other way. I think they made him qualify again, and because he had my engine in there, see? But he just barely made the race. And that's some of the stuff that Gurney and I used to, or that Penske and I used to go through. And it was kind of like Gurney and I and Jerry Grant. You know, I mean, always a problem with my backup driver or the second driver. And that's the reason I didn't like a backup team or a second driver team, you know. Let me do it. I'll beat her down. Well, I freaking know how to win a race, you know.
And, you know, that race finished, no controversy, very easy, very nice, nothing to talk about. Yeah, oh, Lord. Right. you thought you got the drama out of the way early. Nope. But, wow,
yeah,
how crazy.
I was down in Atlanta one time. This is same car for Penske, right? And it was a, I don't know, probably the 80 car. I don't remember exactly. And it wasn't the 81 car, I don't think. But at any rate, I'm down there now. I got this goddamn oil that AMSOIL makes for me, both for engine oil if I want to use it, and my mechanics will sneak anything in I want, believe me. But I'm using the rear end lube. Now, I've been doing it down at Atlanta, and would you believe I blow the rear end?
Huh.
Now, that shouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I mean, how do I blow rear ends? I mean, you run them wide open. If you can, that's it, you know? And I'm not running a road course and running the oval down there. And so I blow the rear end. That goddamn Earl, when he got back to the race shop, he tells Penske, and of course everybody else back there, that I'm running this AMSOIL in it. That I'm not running that cam too. Well, fuck, I've been doing this for, 2 years? And nobody's caught me yet. Why should they catch me now,
yeah.
You know? Just because I finally blew a transmission? Not fair, you know? So at any rate, whatever the hell it was, Roger and I got into a hassle over that one. And same thing, I told him, this is my race car, I call the shots. This is the way we do it. This is what you and I shook hands on in that hotel in England, in London. He said again, okay, I realize that. Okay, forget about it. It's done with. So that's how I got him out of my rear end deal that he caught me with, you know?
Well, my friend, I cannot wait to see you in Indy, and we're going to look forward to telling a lot more tales, some of them even true. And that's always just a really special part of the month of May, of you and me and Miller on our little row of infamy and just spinning yarn.
And that was Uncle Bobby in all of his unfiltered splendor. As I mentioned at the open, I'm sure that we're going to capture some more. I know I want to get thoughts from him about racing an Audi up Pikes Peak, and there's plenty of other good stuff for us to delve into. So if you have ideas, if you have things you want to hear from the good Mr. Unser, shoot me a note on Twitter or Facebook or whatever you prefer, and who knows, I might even send out a request for questions, and we will have some fun with the dear, dear man when he is here with us in the media center. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is a Marshall Pruitt podcast. Thank you for listening.